Well, the term thought leadership is used these days. Some critics think it's a self-indulgent term, but it does at least convey a distinct idea, I'd suggest, and my next guest, Alan Rusbridger, surely falls into this category. He spent 20 eventful years as the editor-in-chief of The Guardian newspaper, and noted for winning high-profile legal cases for free speech. Plus, he oversaw the consolidation of the paper's print and digital operations, and that is no easy feat. He's now a member of the Facebook Oversight Board. He chairs the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. And for the past 6 years, he's been principal at Lady Margaret Hall at the University of Oxford, from which he's stepping down very soon. And we thought he'd retired. But he's back, taking on a new role at the helm of the increasingly influential London-based print and online public affairs journal Prospect. Why did he step into the fray again, we wondered. Well, Alan joins me. Hello there.
Hello there.
Did you think you'd retired?
I shied away from the R word because, I was planning to do a life that included Facebook and a lot of writing. But then this approach came, and Prospect is a magazine that I've admired. It's about 20 years old, and I kind of think that something like this is needed at the moment in a world that really has two things journalistically. One is speed, you know, everything's getting faster and faster and faster and shorter and shorter, and everything is getting more polarized. And Prospect is a very slow magazine, and I think it should offer up the space where people can get together and listen to each other rather than shout. So I thought that was too good to pass up.
Do you think the pandemic's been good for journalism?
Well, it's the first time in my lifetime that I think journalists realised that what they were doing was a matter of life and death. You know, that's obviously true in wartime, but so I think it was a sobering moment for journalism. And by and large, I think journalists have risen to the challenge well and realised that it really matters what they write and that they've got to get it right and that they have a responsibility to understand the science and to report it fairly and accurately. Of course, we can all think of examples of journalism that hasn't looked like that and can't resist the impulse to take sides and to follow ideological lines. But I think broadly, journalism has risen to the challenge.
It's been interesting to see egos there. It's been an extraordinary time, I think, to look on at each other and to look on at our own craft and just how much there has an emphasis on critiquing governments who are learning as they go, some better than others, and or to actually be utterly constructive as if we were in a war. We just can't see the enemy at the doorstep. Have you sensed there's a tension there?
Yes, and early on, I think there was an instinct from some journalists, to fall in line. You see the same thing at times of war, where you think, well, I now have to choose my side, and it's not fair to critique the government as I would normally. By the way, I think that's the wrong instinct. I think journalists always have to stand aside and be critical and not suspend their critical faculties. The alternative is news channels. I'm sure we can all think of examples where the instinct to take sides is kind of irresistible. And depending on which side you're on, you suppress the right, to my mind, journalistic instinct to follow the facts and to stick with what you know, and to pick up the megaphone and shout on behalf of whatever prejudice you have.
Well, there's a risk you become tribalised, isn't there?
Well, I think that's what I was talking about at the beginning of this conversation. That so much debate is now tribalised, and people feel comfortable sometimes in one tribe or the other. But the more that happens, I think the more there is a duty to create spaces that aren't tribal.
What about, again, the tension about creating fear and creating a sense of the safe places to step out? I mean, this is obviously incredibly, it's been amazingly important here in Australia anyway. I don't think it's been quite the same in the UK about vaccinations, about the safety of and the risk management and risk understanding of various vaccines. This has been extremely vexed and it's not over yet. Now, have you sort of wrestled with that?
Yes, and again, there are some news outlets where you feel they are instinctively, let's call it pro-freedom. Maybe that's a loaded term in itself, but where they're very sceptical about the controls that we continue to have to some extent, and have used their front pages to effectively campaign to have controls dropped. Again, that doesn't answer to my idea of what journalism should be, because I don't think you should be using certainly your news pages in that way. Of course, as you can say what you like in your comment pages. Mm. I also think of saving your own blushes that the pandemic has shown the importance of having a public media, a public service media, which is free and open to all, and which is legally obliged to be as impartial as possible. I think in a way, the more that you have an opinionated press, the more valuable spaces like the BBC and ABC in Canada, CBC, and other equivalents across Europe are.
Well, I mean, it has been also a moment in Australia with this amazing multicultural nation of wonders that we have created to realise which groups do access what you might call mainstream media, which includes the public broadcaster, but others as well, and which groups do not, and who use their own often very mixed competence amounts of information. And here you are going often into very complex science, which we're all, scientific literacy is, you know, hardly great anywhere. And this is really, again, emerging as a major, major issue.
Yeah, well, of course, you can't force anybody to listen to the ABC or watch the BBC. But equally, it's a very bad moment for those who would like to weaken these institutions to be making that case, because the BBC in the UK is still watched by 90% of the population and is easily, despite its faults, despite the reservations about it, is easily the most trusted news outlet in the UK. Yes, people will go off to their fringe outlets and the echo chambers that they admire. But as long as you've got that tent peg in the ground so that people can say, well, at least I trust the BBC or ABC to give this to me straight. And the fact that they still have science correspondence, you know, we all know that the condition of journalism is threatened economically. And it's a great temptation just to sack the people who are the most expensive, which tends to be the people who are the most knowledgeable.
Alan Risbridger is my guest. He's taking up the role of the editor of Prospect magazine. What do you think the pandemic has revealed about people's essential trust in journalism?
Well, again, I think it's... I mean, there has been a declining trend in trust in journalism worldwide. But I think it's bounced back a little during the pandemic for the reasons that we've been talking about. I think people are drowning in sources of information and increasingly don't know who to believe. There was a survey about 2 or 3 years ago that the Reuters Institute did where people were, 2/3 of people said they no longer knew a good source from a bad source. But I think there has been a return, if you like, to safety. That people have come back to sort of recognize news brands and said it these are probably people I can trust. I mean, it's good, I think, for readers and listeners to have a degree of skepticism, So you wouldn't expect unflinching admiration for everything that we do. But if you've got people who are saying, well, I could probably, if it's on the ABC, if it's at the BBC, if it's in this newspaper or that newspaper, I can probably trust it. That's probably the highest you can expect at the moment.
Well, there was that Edelman mid-March survey you were telling our producer about, of a survey of trust. And the journalists, COVID journalists, were at the bottom of the league. And it was there again in the YouGov Sky News survey of a week ago, and in the Eurobarometer survey, the trust in, you know, trust in the journalists, as I'm not sure if it was actually their outlets, but the journalists was really very low. It was quite troubling.
Well, yes, I'm trying to put the best possible gloss I can on
right.
it. I mean, but I began by saying that, you know, generally the picture has been declining. And so this is from a low base. And I think it's a question journalists don't ask themselves enough, is to why do we have such low levels of trust when trust is all we've got to sell? You know, if people don't believe what we're saying, then that's a terrible problem.
Yes. I mean, it is. Do you find with younger journalists, I'm wondering whether, and it'll be interesting when you go to prospect, that there's very much that need to, with a quite more individualistic culture, you have to cut through. So often there's a search for gotcha moments, which lead to headlines, which improve your own sort of perceived profile, that this is not necessarily in the best interests of overall trust. Speaking as somebody who's been around for a while.
Well, I more generally, I think there is an urgent need to have what you might call media studies, but really is broader than media studies. It's about being a good citizen. Certainly in the UK, the idea of media studies has always been sneered at as a kind of sort of non-subject, an easy subject, a silly subject. But if we're raising a generation of people who don't know who to believe and who don't know who to trust, that is terrible for democracy. It really is. I mean, if you think of COVID as a dress rehearsal for climate change, if you've got a population that simply won't believe that it's happening because they don't trust anybody telling them anything, then you're never going to be able to get through the policies that we're going to need in order to survive as a race. So there are some big stakes here, and I think it has to begin in school. It has to begin with very elementary lessons about how you evaluate information and how you can be a skeptical reader, but how you can place your trust where it deserves to be placed.
Yes, I mean, you've spent the last 6 years as principal at Lady Margaret Hall. Have you noticed a change in how young people approach the notion of evaluating information and indeed free speech itself?
Well, two different things. So evaluating information, in a way, some of the surveys that I've seen say actually the problem is with older people, that younger people have grown up quite savvy in terms of negotiating the digital ocean and working out what to believe and what not to believe. Freedom of speech, I think, is different. I think there is, regrettably, a tendency amongst some young people, maybe even the majority now, where they haven't been taught the basics of why free speech matters. And you do get, in some people, a sort of retreat to, I want to live in this safe space or that safe space, and your argument offends me, and therefore you shouldn't be allowed to make that argument. That to my mind, is a really dangerous path to be going down. But I'm surprised that the young people haven't, by the time they get to university, they haven't got the grounding that you would expect in the basic arguments about why free speech matters.
And is this, you do see this, do you? You said it earlier, that in a way what we're going through is a dress rehearsal for the extraordinary volatility of information and decision-making that might accompany climate change?
Yeah, but, you know, politicians we know are going to have to make some very tough choices, and they're going to be unpopular choices. And it can only work if you have a majority of the population, I would say a substantial majority of the population, who A, begin by believing that there is such a thing as climate change, and B, that the kind of measures that we're going to have to endure are necessary at speed. And I think it is worrying for democracies. Oddly enough, I think countries like, let's say, China may be better placed because there's more of a tradition of rulers deciding and people following. If you live in messy democracies where things have to be done by consensus, you're not going to get a consensus if there is no bedrock of agreed facts to start with.
Mm. Look, a final question just is different, but it goes to your earlier life, I suppose. In May, the UK Home Office published a consultation paper containing a number of proposals to revise the Official Secrets Act. And now, the law makes it a criminal offence for current or former government employees to leak certain types of information considered damaging. And anyone, including journalists, can be prosecuted for publishing leaked information. As part of the consultation, I understand the government did not endorse a recommendation from the Commission to include a specific public interest defence. We've been talking about public interest journalism here. Do you think this is a reflection, Alan, of the government's opinion of journalists in the UK?
I'm afraid it is, and it's surprising to come from a government that is led by former journalists. And regrettably, the UK is following the lead set by Australia some years ago in tightening up the rules around official information. I think in the wider public, there's a failure to appreciate that most of the valuable information that journalists impart comes from unauthorized sources. And people leak stuff for all kinds of good and bad motives. But if you start to turn the act of leaking, which we might also call whistleblowing, and start to criminalize that imparting and receipt of information, you're going down a very, very dangerous step. And you're right to say that the Law Commission did recommend that there should be a public interest defense available to both journalists and sources. And the government is currently not entertaining that. And I think we will see a number of journalists in jail. And I think that will look terrible. And the governments will live to regret these measures. But I think it's a panic measure brought in at a time of crisis. You know, COVID is a crisis. And we know in the past that the crises have led to bad bits of legislation around official information.
Oh, well, look, I shall be watching and reading.
Good, take out a subscription, yeah.
So good luck, and thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you. It's been enjoyable.
Alan Rusbridger, former editor-in-chief of The Guardian, soon to be editor of Prospect magazine.